and you're on the front porch where we tackle the tough issues facing West Virginia and Appalachia like you and your friends do on your front porch. On this week's show, we'll debate Charleston's Needle Exchange Program, which has been in the news a lot lately. There are some issues with first responders and others finding hypodermic needles where they shouldn't be. On the other hand, the program has been very effective in preventing things like hepatitis and AIDS. How can we protect first responders and others and preserve those health gains and not stigmatize people who have addiction? Also, I'll be trading the green rolling hills of West Virginia for the mean streets of Vermont. Rick Wilson will give me some tips on how to survive the maple tree jungle. I'm Scott Finn, outgoing Grand Poobah of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, soon to be CEO and Chief Dog Catcher at Vermont Public Radio. And I'm joined by PhD economist Jesse Troyan, who works for the Free Market Cardinal Institute here in Charleston. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Scott.
And progressive columnist Rick Wilson with the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
You know the story probably. Kanawha Charleston Health Department started a needle exchange program several years ago to help people with addiction to be able to avoid getting AIDS or hepatitis. By all accounts, it's working. Especially hepatitis rates are down and AIDS cases have been kept in check. But meanwhile, there's been frustration among first responders in the city of Charleston about this, the high number of needles they're finding on people and also in structures. And the new police chief has been blaming the needle exchange program for those needles. And outgoing Mayor Danny Jones has as well.
Well, I understand the frustration of first responders. I mean, I've seen hypodermic needles in Charleston. But, I mean, to get into conventional economics when it comes to addiction, they talk about there's elastic and inelastic demand. If you're addicted to an injectable opioid, that is an inelastic demand. That means it's not going to go away because you have trouble. If fewer needles, people just use the same needles over and over again. They have more and more health costs. People who take part in needle exchange programs are much more likely to actually get treatment eventually, like five times more likely than people who don't. So, again, it comes down to the big difference between making something go away versus making something illegal or banning it.
Yes, we want to see the drug addiction problem in our neighborhoods go away. We want to quit losing our loved ones to these addictions. But in the meantime, let's focus on how can we reduce the harms. These needle-borne illnesses, you know, HIV, hepatitis, those have very real long-term and very burdensome long-term costs.
On one hand, I do think that there's some evidence now that some of the needles that were given away, you know, never came back. There was a really good article that we did here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting about HealthRight, which is a nonprofit that has its own needle exchange and does it differently. They've decided to go to a one-time needle use program where the needle, after it's used, will immediately retract into a plastic case, which makes it very difficult to reuse at all. And also, the HealthRight program is a needle-for-needle exchange. If you don't come back with all your needles, you're out of the program. Those are legitimate concerns. On the other hand, there's a way to bring that up that does not demonize people with addiction problems who are our brothers and sisters. In the case of Mayor Danny Jones, who's doing a lot of the demonizing, he's doing it in such a way that is doing real harm to people. Already there are folks that are dropping out of the needle exchange program at Kanawha Charleston Health Department because of the publicity alone. It's not the Mayor Jones I know. And I don't know if he's reachable, but if there's someone who can reach out to him and just say, thank you for bringing up the problem. We're not minimizing. And God knows our first responders have had to carry the burden of this with very little help, with very little thanks. That's important to recognize. We need to hear them when they ask for help. But please don't say things that inflame the issue to the point where people die. That's the plea. That's all I got to say on that.
So there is a Bible verse that comes to mind. You see, I've been slacking on the Bible verses lately, but there's one from Proverbs. There is a way that seemeth right to a man, but the end thereof is destruction. I mean, there's some things that might seem like the right thing to do, but it doesn't work out the way you think it's going to.
Yeah, in the moment, you can feel like, I'm doing this thing that's, you know, I'm standing up for what I believe in. And I know Mayer's frustrated with what he felt was just intransigence from people to recognize the needle problem. And I get it. Now, here's the other thing, though. This is largely a NIMBY problem. I saw an article in the Charleston Gazette Mail with the Charleston police chief, where the police chief, he didn't say we should get rid of the program. He said we should just move it outside of Charleston. We should have a needle exchange program, but just someplace else, not in my town. And I'm just like, look, Charleston gets the benefits of being the capital city. We have a basketball tournament going on here right now. We have state government. Matter of fact, there was a lawsuit when they wanted to move some of the agencies of state government outside of Charleston. And, you know, Charleston fought very hard to keep government here. Well, with great power comes great responsibility. And maybe, yes, maybe Charleston does need to shoulder the burden of helping to police the issues that come with having the needle exchange. You know, it's part of being a great city. And I seriously hope this is, I'm going to give folks the benefit of the doubt. We've had J.B. Akers on this program, remember? Who's running for mayor on the Republican side. He's had the support of Mayor Jones.
He's a Milton High School graduate, by the way.
So, you know, by definition, good guy, by definition. You know, he needs to speak up on this in the right way. And he needs to speak to his friend Danny Jones on this in the right way, too. Please. Okay, we've had our Bible verse. We've had our sermon from me. So, yeah, I've accepted this job to be the new leader of Vermont Public Radio as of May 7th. You know, the main reason, it's just a really good opportunity for me and my family and my son. A lot of you guys know he has autism, and, you know, the services there, just frankly, because it's a wealthier state, are probably more secure. West Virginia Public Broadcasting is fine. I know that rumors get started at times like this. We're actually better than we've been in the 5 years since I got here. Our fundraising is way up. Our audience is way up. We've secured our state funding for this year at a level amount from last year, actually up just a little bit. So you're going to tell me about Vermont, Rick.
Yeah, you are so lucky that I am here, Scott, because I took one for the team several years ago and married a person from Vermont. I mean, I wouldn't recommend that to everybody, but I think I can sort of help you maybe survive this transition.
Okay, I'm worried about it.
Oh, yeah. It's like when you go, it's kind of like being in a maximum security prison. The people who've been in Vermont a little bit longer, you know, are going to look at the new guys, especially relatively young guys like you. You show any weakness, you'll be sold for a carton of cigarettes, dude. It's really, really pretty brutal.
Okay. I think you're full of crap. I can go back to the episode where you talked about Vermont as being, quote unquote, the Shire from Lord of the Rings. You know, the happy place where the hobbits run around and live. So, really?
I just got to mess with you, Scott. The other thing, like, don't make any eye contact with them at all. They'll just rip out your jugular with their teeth, and that's the Methodist women there, so it gets rougher. But, yeah, I'm having fun with Vermont because it is really true. I do think it's like the Shire. West Virginia is on the edge of Mordor with the Dark Lord progressively taking over, and Vermont really is happy hobbit place. They do have some serious social problems there, Scott. Sometimes they tamper with the grade of maple syrup. Like, they'll pass it off as, like, you know, grade A and it's B.
Maple syrup fraud.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
I'm sure, look, I think it's too late for them to rescind my offer, but I could get fired. So I'm going to be cautious about this. As I've said many times before, the views of Rick Wilson are not necessarily the views of West Virginia Public Broadcasting or this executive director. But yeah, seriously, though, he can't do it.
I can't do it. I mean, on the, like, the, you will have, like, more, you know, white baristas with dreadlocks in Burlington than we do here. I mean, there are certain things, you know, kind of balance out a little bit.
Well, in Burlington, as I'm finding out, is the sort of the hip cultural center, lots of young people because it's a university town, and it's different from the rest of the state, which is more small towns and, you know, older people in general and that sort of thing, right? I mean, it's not all just one place.
Yeah, in fact, I would say Charleston is more like West Virginia than Burlington's like Vermont. I mean, you know, you can say of both of them that West Virginia is half an hour away from Charleston, you know, or what. Vice versa, but not, I mean, Burlington really is kind of a bubble, but.
So give me, like, a similarity based on your intimate knowledge of a Vermonter, and then also maybe a difference between here and there?
It's a very rural state. In some ways, probably more rural than we are. The way they handle winter is going to be completely different to you. People really take government seriously there, I mean, including town government and everything else. And you ought to hear my wife rant when we get like a half an inch of snow and the world shuts down. You know, it's more like towns than counties, the way we do things. It's probably not as central. You know, there's a lot of – it's really high in gun ownership, but again, a really low crime rate. They have open carry laws there.
So it's interesting to me because in some ways it's so similar. I mean, the Green Mountains and the hills here in West Virginia, there's some similarities there. And also the sort of the rural nature of a lot of people. We're both kind of older than the national average in the, our median age. We have a large proportion of white people compared to the rest of the country. Similarities. But wow, here's one difference. Gallup polled all the states of job approval for President Trump. And West Virginia has the highest job approval for President Trump, and Vermont has the lowest. And so, you know, I think both of us get our backs up when people stereotype us in a certain way. But, you know, there's always some truth to some of the stereotypes.
So one big difference.
Wait a second. I'm sorry. My fault.
One big difference, if you look at the economy, is that West Virginia is basically a mineral colony. A lot of our land and resources have been owned for a century by out-of-state corporations that have sucked everything away and trashed the place. Vermont is largely owned by Vermonters. I mean, they went through like a period of deforestation 100 years ago, you know, when there's this wool and all this stuff, but it's really much more locally owned, much more sustainable, much more of an emphasis on agriculture and keeping money in the community and on quality. You don't have billboards there. You have to pay. You can pay for your own highway sign, but they don't have billboards trashing the landscape.
Well, I'd really like to bring in the economist just for a second because so there's two things going on in Vermont that are interesting. One is it does seem like there is just a ton of small scale capitalism, lots and lots of small business ownership, and lots of people owning small bits of land and making money off of that. In general, is that healthy for capitalism for lots of people to be small-scale capitalists?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is just basic diversification that you have, you know, like you said, all of these smaller businesses that kind of fulfill each of these different niches. And I'm sure in a town like Burlington, in sort of a college town, maybe in the same way that Morgantown has a bunch of these like kitschy little shops that satisfy different needs that, you know, if you can dream it and you can, if you can dream of it, you can probably find it there. As opposed to maybe more of what we tend to see in West Virginia, that it's just kind of these much larger, a little bit more kind of homogenized, for lack of a better description. Yeah, I think more of this diversification, think of maybe a more relevant comparison here is think of, you know, the bubbling kind of artistic type of community over on the west side versus going out to Southridge.
Yeah. And then I mean, what you're starting to see in places like Thomas, West Virginia, is that sort of thing as well.
Lewisburg.
I mean, I'm going to leave out a lot of towns, but you know what I'm talking about. Vermont's already been through that. And it's an economy that has tourism and makes money off of that. But also, the tourism has led to people moving there. A lot of the people on the board of Vermont Public Radio are not originally from Vermont. They've come there for the amenities. A lot of times they find out about Vermont in summer camp or by coming there for a vacation, and then they want to stay, and then they build a business there. So tourism is a lot more than just having someone come in and visit and leave. It's also someone maybe deciding that this is a great place that I want to start my new business and coming in with resources and capital.
So they're a real leader too, like the local food movement, you know, which is a huge deal when you produce and raise a lot of it there. I mean, they have a lot of farms that went under. The 80s were really brutal in Vermont. Another thing, Vermont historically is really Republican, although Vermont Republican is not the same. It's more like a... like the John Prine song, voted for Eisenhower because Lincoln won the war kind of thing.
Yeah, they have a Republican governor, Phil Scott, as governor. And the you know, he's trying to hold the line on property taxes. Now,
That's a big difference.
Is a big, huge. Oh my. Yes, the property taxes are much higher, and the cost of living is somewhat higher too. So there's a trade-off there. And one of the things they're facing, Jesse, is they're in general, they have a higher median income and everything, but they also have slower growth than a lot of states. And even West Virginia grew faster in the last quarter than they did. And so they're really worried. There's a worry about not having enough economic growth to keep everything going. And that's sort of a trade-off, isn't it? If it's a higher tax, highly regulated state, does that in general have an impact on things like growth?
Yeah, absolutely, because these regulations are going to stifle the creative process in business. If you have this red tape that you have to cut through, the hoops that you have to jump through, the different licensing boards that you have to deal with, that's time and effort and resources, you know, that you're not investing into whatever your business venture is. And so then the inertia is going to take a stronger hold because, you know, maybe the, you know, the marginal benefit of, you know, taking this new risk in maybe branching off one of your businesses, starting a new one, those costs to starting this up or somehow expanding upon it are going to be higher. So you kind of stick with, you know, what you've cleared the regulation for.
I mean, one thing you'll see is a big difference. It's like you can't just like trash a whole area there. They have something like zoning. So Vermont is not as trashed as much of West Virginia is. Also, here's an anecdote. I think my wife was in a store in Vermont and someone overheard that she was living in West Virginia. He goes, I'm thinking about going to West Virginia. I hear the property taxes are lower there. And she said, yeah, and you get exactly what you pay for, too. And also, one reason why property taxes are low here is it really benefits the absentee landowners of the state. It has nothing to do with it. It's a side effect.
Well, I just want to say it's an interesting comparison. There is a lot of differences, but there's some enough similarities that it's kind of cool to kind of see the different paths that each state has taken. In general, I just want to say, you know, that this has been, West Virginia has been so very good to me and my family. And we are just so grateful. I don't want to turn this into a hashtag struggle to stay thing because it's really not about that for us. It's really more about just, you know, a great opportunity to live in a place that reminds us of West Virginia, but where, you know, frankly, we might be able to earn more income. It's a very capitalist thing. And also, you know, be able to hopefully have a better life for my son in the long run, which highlights one of West Virginia's problems, which no one here, it's not anyone's fault who lives here. But when you start out in a harder economic place, whether you're an individual or a state, it creates all sorts of issues that make it difficult to get out of it. And that, I think, is at the end of the day, we blame all sorts of things. We blame, you know, policies and politics for, you know, out-of-state corporations or, you know, unions and Democrats. But at the end of the day, I think the crux of it is it's wealth tends to beget wealth and poverty tends to beget poverty. And it's difficult to break those cycles. But I've, you know, been happy to be part of that fight for most of my adult life. And we'll always be West Virginians, no matter where we are. So, and, you know, it's been an amazing 5 years. So thank you. And, you know, and thank you, Rick and Jesse, for doing this. This is always a highlight of my week. Thanks to Lori Lynn, the previous host of The Front Porch, who really helped us get this started in the right way. I'm Scott Finn, outgoing Grand Poobah of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. That was Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, and be careful up there.
And thank you, too, to Jesse Tryon of the Free Market Carnal Institute. Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
All right, take care, y'all. Bye.
Yeah, listen. From Jerome.